Welcome to the Nerd Trap. I'm Josh Look.
I'm Jeff Luce.
I'm Al Rose.
I'm Shelly Rose.
And the episode today that we're going to be talking about is Charlie X. Second episode to be aired, correct, Jeff?
Second episode aired September 15th, 1966. Long, long ago.
You know, I'm not sure that all our audience members know that the Repo in Repo Man stands for Researches Everything. professionally,
or otherwise,
online.
That's right.
Excellent.
Absolutely. So, Repo Man has researched. He's gone into the extensive Wikipedia library.
IMDb trivia.
Right. So, anyway, the thing was written by DC Fontana, which is the D standing for Dorothy.
Based on a story by.
Well, we're going to get to that in a minute. Talk a little bit about D.C. Fontana. Female writer, not very usual in the 60s, although there were some.
That's why she's D.C.
That's right. Because, well, let me say this. While I was doing research on D.C. Fontana, I found that the Legends of TV organization. It's a preservation society that wants to talk to the people that were in the early days, the mid days, the golden age of TV. And they did a 3-hour interview with DC Fontana. And before the podcast, I was all willing to shred DC Fontana. For God's sake, she wrote Encounter at Farpoint, the premiere episode of The Next Generation.
And The Way to Eden. Right?
Yeah.
But you know what? The thing about DC Fontana is that while Gene Roddenberry was the visionary in terms of the science fiction and all that part of it, the thing that she brought to it was the characters.
That's true.
And that's really why we watch. And if you look at the episodes that she wrote, they're maybe not always the strongest episodes, but they always have really great character stuff.
That's true.
Like Journey to Babel, where we meet Spock's parents, for God's sake.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Like, that's what her stuff is about. It's about the relationships, and it's about the characters, and it's really important stuff, even if it's not firing phasers and all that kind of stuff.
True.
She writes good dialogue.
She writes good characters. Even when she did some stuff on Babylon 5, you know, I was like, what the hell is going on here? There's good dialogue in this episode.
That's not how it was last week.
I did notice that about this episode. The dialogue is really, really good. And
that's true.
Believable.
Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah.
not like, you know, the cliched Kirk, "We've got to..." You know, it's none of that stuff. It's actual believable dialogue.
Right.
So anyway, in this, I recommend everybody check out this interview because she really is quite fascinating. And it's at metvlegends.org. It's a 3-hour interview. They break it down into 7 parts. Fascinating stuff because not only was she the writer, the way she got into the career was she did it the old-fashioned way, through the back door, you know? She was a secretary in the typing pool, then became the assistant to a guy doing a different show, met Roddenberry when he was doing his police show, and he took her with him when he went to do Star Trek.
Right.
And all the time she's telling these guys that she's working for that she wants to be a writer too. That's really why she's there. So she gets to step up because she's just not coming in through the mailroom. She's right there. They look at her scripts and they all tell her. I mean, we often hear it's hard for women and that they were discriminated against, which is true. But she could see them it's easy to be that way in the abstract when you're not looking at the person. When she's dealing with these producers and saying she wants to do this, they're all like, "Well, write a good story, and I'll buy it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't give a damn where it comes from." And that's how she got her foot in the door.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But as far as the episode we're talking about tonight, which is Charlie X, Josh, you want to give us a rundown of the basic plot of the show?
So Charlie X is a story about the crew of the Enterprise. Picks up. What are they doing with this other ship? It's a cargo ship, right?
Cargo ship.
They meet the Antares.
They meet the Antares.
In like 2 seconds of CGI at the very beginning of it, you get to see the Antares. Yes. It's so cool. I watched it like 3 times.
That was actually one of the points that I actually wrote down was how cool in the new enhanced special effects version of the show, how cool that cargo ship looks.
It's really great.
It's really fantastic.
Right. It's like 2 seconds, but it's just so super. With that
right.
The one engine off to the side.
Yep. Yeah.
Really great.
Yeah, but it still looks,
right.
It still ties into that, you know, that yep. Federation yep. Universe stuff, which I think we talked about on our last episode a little bit. So the crew of the Enterprise meets the Antares. They pick up this young boy who's going to
He's been rescued from a planet where there's no life, but there's legends of an ancient race.
Right.
Right. And he's an adolescent. He's never met humans. And they have to transport him to where he's going to meet his family.
Right. Which is, what's
Colony
the name?
Five.
Colony 5. Colony 5. Colony 5. Thank you, Jeff. Yeah. So he's going to Colony 5, and the crew seems pretty anxious to get out of there, right?
Right. Right.
So they take off, and almost immediately upon getting on the ship.
They
were offered. They were offered. They're just that, yep, we got to get out of here. Charlie encounters Janice Rand very early on, and this is the first time he's ever seen a girl.
And what a girl!
He has to ask, is this a girl? Is that a girl?
Kirk says,
yes, that's a girl. So Charlie, through multiple encounters with the rest of the crew, makes it pretty obvious to the viewer that all he really wants to do is fit in. He wants to fit in. He wants to be liked. He wants Janice Rand.
Totally. He's going through all of the difficult pieces of being an adolescent.
True.
That he's feeling love, that he's feeling nobody likes him,
yeah.
And that everybody's against him, and yeah. that he wants to fit in, he wants to be like everybody else.
Adolescence, I thought that was last week.
I'm going to feel that way in an hour from now.
How can I make them like me?
When I go home and I think about how I... Oh, man, I spent my evening doing a podcast about Star Trek. I'm going to feel very unliked. So, Charlie tries to impress Janice Rand through multiple different situations. He tries to show her some card tricks, which is really creepy. He pulls out some cards that happen to have some pretty stunning glamour photos of Janice Rand.
Right.
I'd pay some money for that.
Doesn't he bring her, like, her favorite perfume?
Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
He does some things.
He does some things.
The card trick bit is cute.
Yeah.
And
realistic.
I'm sure we're going to talk about her singing.
We are going to talk about that.
But he finally gets her attention away from her singing. And does the card tricks, and yeah, it's realistic until the one where all of a sudden it's in her bra.
Right.
Like, I would think that around that point, someone would think, you know what? Mm-hmm. There's something funky going on with this kid. Like, that's more than just a card trick when you make something actually materialize inside my clothing.
Right. So they're hinting towards that, though. The crew of the Antares they make contact with the Enterprise once they're off the ship. And it's kind of unclear. Are they like a ways down the road at this point?
Right. They're just on the edge of communication.
Exactly. Right.
Because they're trying to warn the Enterprise. They feel bad. They're like, oh, Kirk officer, it's the Saurian Brandy.
Should have told him.
And they try to tell him,
I think it's more the ship blows up.
He removes the baffle plate.
Yeah.
You know, those baffle plates are very, very dangerous.
It was going to blow up.
It was going to blow up anyway. It was going to blow up
anyway, but that's how Christopher Pike is hurt as well.
Is it?
Really?
No. Wow.
Yeah, so
fascinating.
But I think it's more that it's not that they feel remorse. It was that Charlie made them unable
to
tell Kirk. Because the basic conceit that we haven't yet mentioned here is that while Charlie is on this planet where he was stranded after a shipwreck, he was raised by the Thasians, who imparted super mental powers upon Charlie, allowing him to do it. But he doesn't say that. No, he doesn't say that, but that's...
He doesn't even want to tell him about the Thasians.
Right, but the Thasians give him these powers that allow him to survive, and as he enters the Enterprise, he's using these powers to try to fit in and be liked.
Right. Things escalate. He starts to get kind of violent, almost. He gets threatening.
Oh, he does get violent.
The
guy disappear and leaves his towel behind.
Exactly,
Sam.
But it's Sam.
And he makes Rand disappear.
He makes Rand disappear,
and
too.
And he turns a girl into a lizard and makes the faceless girl.
Right.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Which, by the way, terrified me as a kid. That struck me.
Wow, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Yeah.
Well... We're talking about this bit here. Well, I guess we'll talk about it again
when
it comes to special effects. But what a great Star Trek moment that is.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where you see the shadows and they're laughing, and he says, "No laughing," and the shadows all freeze. Yep. Except you hear the corner of her hands coming around, feeling the burn. No, her face is completely blank, no mouth, no nose.
It's so quick, too. It's just a quick shot. It doesn't linger on it, like, whatsoever.
It didn't linger on it, but my little mind lingered on it for a long time. To that girl, what is she experiencing? Can she breathe? You know, what is going on?
So things come to a head. When Charlie makes his way onto the bridge.
Mm-hmm. He's taken over the ship.
And just when it looks like the Enterprise is completely screwed, who shows up but the Thasians.
They're exactly.
They're there to take Charlie back.
And that's in what is maybe one of the top 10 Star Trek scenes.
Oh, yes.
It is, yeah.
It's just fantastic. The acting,
that whole
the guy that plays Charlie Evans, whatever his name is, Research Man.
Oh, Jesus.
but he's just
We didn't check to see what else he was in.
No, I did. The guy that plays Charlie X, his stepfather, was one of the major producers in Hollywood at that time. And, I mean, like, we're talking Louis B. Mayer.
So he's a connected guy.
Right.
But he's great, but nonetheless. And that final scene.
Well, that's the thing.
Like, you know, don't let him take me.
That's the thing. He did a bunch of stuff leading up to this, but he was, I want to make it on my own, and didn't want to use the connections that he had, which is why you don't know anything else he's ever been in. If he had leveraged his stepdadage,
he could have been someone.
Yeah, he could have been
someone. Because he is really just a great actor in this episode. Yeah. He's fantastic.
Right. They can't feel, not like you and me. Right. Yeah. They don't love.
But even just even
when I came aboard.
Not only that, but like the subtle facial expressions he makes.
Oh, and not to mention that amazing ability that he has to do that thing where you can only see the whites of his eyes.
Yeah, right. He does do that quite a bit. I was going to say, he's really good at rolling his eyes into the back of his head.
That was definitely a big part of,
of how he got the part, you think?
Let me see you roll your eyes back up.
So the Thasians take him back. And there's this wonderful scene that really, I don't think we could do it justice. It really needs to be seen. And the crew, despite all their problems, I mean, everything comes back to normal. I would assume without the, with the exception of the Antares coming back, because that ship blew up.
Those people say specifically are
dead.
Yeah, they
can't bring them back.
But the crew
don't really ever tell us what happened to the woman with the face.
No, we don't.
No, no.
they say everything is as it was.
And they say your crew was returned to you.
Right.
So you got to assume Lizard Girl is back.
Lizard
Girl's
She's
back.
Not a lizard.
Faceless girl, faced.
She's faced. She just has these ever
horror.
Haunting memory.
Right. Suffocating because she has no mouth.
And the crew's kind of left. Very somber because they feel they feel pretty terrible. I mean, they felt
Kirk almost wants to give him a chance at the end.
Yeah.
Or do you want to talk about the end scene? Because
well, we kind of are, Jeff.
All right. I think it's one of the greatest scenes in Star Trek, and the beauty of it is that the character of Charlie is written in such a way, and the dialogue is in such a way that despite all the shit he has done, he's murdered, he's mutilated, he's maimed, he's sexually assaulted, he's just been a total creep, but in that last 3 minutes, when he's pleading for them not to let them take him away, he doesn't want to go back to the Thasians, you actually, and Kirk says this too, he's like, he deserves to be with his own kind. Is there nothing we can do?
Right.
And the Thasians are like, look, get your head out of your ass. Either you're going to have to kill him, or he's going to destroy all of you.
Right.
And he's got to go. And at the last minute, Charlie is going to the back end of the bridge where he does his classic I want to stay line.
Yeah.
And Janice Rand actually goes out to hug him or something.
Yeah.
And she's pulled back by Spock.
Right.
I thought that was great.
Yeah.
It's just a little flourish that was really fantastic.
I think one of the things that, you know, when I watched it today that I was really struck by is that Janice is crying at the end.
Yes.
You know? And it wouldn't have... I wouldn't have bought that because Charlie was, up until that point, so terrible to her.
Yeah.
And threatening. He was scary.
Mm-hmm.
If the dialogue in that scene wasn't as good and the actor, as good as he is, delivering it, I would have been like, really, Janice, you're going to cry about this? But no, I totally buy it. And I'm like, No, they don't love.
Janice is shivering.
I can't even touch him. Doesn't he say that?
Right.
Yeah. It's just, Sorry.
Well, no, Janice shows that she has compassion for him throughout the entire episode. And so even when he is being very threatening to her and very creepy to her, she still is going to Kirk and she's still saying, look, you know, I have compassion for this kid. He has a crush on me, you mm-hmm. know. I don't want to hurt him. So her compassion at the end, or crying at the end, is totally believable because that's the way she's felt all along.
Right. So that's basically the plot of the episode.
Right. Great. And it's really that last scene that makes the episode hold up.
There's a good episode, but that's the.
There's other scenes, and there's also the why people hate Star Trek.
Right, but we'll get to that.
All right, well, let's talk about the
standouts.
The interesting factoid.
Okay.
All right, well, as we mentioned, this show was written by DC Fontana. But when you hear the plot summary of a child with superpowers terrorizing adults, you can't help but think back, if you have any geek cred at all, to the Twilight Zone episode, right? Right, which is called, what is it called now?
It's called It's a Good Life.
It's a Good Life, that's right. Which aired...
And I'm not Al.
Which aired 5 years before. Twilight Zone. But that episode that we're reminded of, because the plot is very similar, in which a child has superpowers that terrorizes a town that kowtow to him and gives Josh one of his classic catchphrases.
It's good. It's good that you did that. Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of a running joke right. in our group.
That show was written by Jerome Bixby. Cool.
Based on a story by Jerome Bixby.
Yeah, that's right. It's based on a story by Jerome Bixby.
Yet the credits in the Star Trek episode say that it's the story by Gene Roddenberry.
That's true.
Yeah.
That's what the credits in the episode say.
I understand,
say.
But we're talking about Twilight Zone here.
Right. I understand that. But and I think it's also really interesting because that's the Roddenberry story. You know, that's the what happens if somebody gets superpowers. You know, well, bad things, right?
It's always bad things.
Right, but Where No Man Has Gone Before,
yep.
This story, and even the cage, the super race got the super mental powers, and, well, it didn't work out so well for them.
Right.
Right? So that's like Gene Roddenberry's story, and that's what this is, even though it certainly is based on. Right. And the thing that's also interesting, though, is that Jerome Bixby did get credit for writing other Star Trek episodes.
He did write this stuff. Mirror, Mirror, but, the greatest of all?
Not this one. This one says teleplay DC Fontana based on a story by Gene Roddenberry.
Well, obviously, right. because the characters are different and the particulars are different, but the theme and the story are pretty much the same.
I guess, even though when they did Arena, they gave credit to Frederick Brown. Did they? Yes, they did.
Yeah, they did.
Based on a story by Frederick Brown, they said.
And that is a situation where the characters are indeed entirely different.
Oh, yeah.
Arena was not a Star Trek story.
So, for whatever reason, Roddenberry wants credit for this one.
Let him.
And
he's 6 foot
two. Seems like it's his story that he's always been telling, and he has the story, and he gives it to his secretary, and she writes it up. And says, you know, I have this great idea where if I write a teleplay based on a story by Gene Roddenberry, they might accept it.
Right. My point here is it's interesting that it's Jerome Bixby, who later on does go on to write three of the greatest Star Trek episodes ever. It's
true.
Mirror, Day of the Dove, fantastic. And Requiem for Methuselah. And Way to Eden is based on a story he wrote. So,
which you hate.
Which I hate.
And what I also think is funny is that he wrote for for the Logan's Run series, TV
series.
Yeah,
we don't talk about
that. Two Star Trek episodes in a row have Logan's Run writers related.
So what you're telling me is that Jeff Luce might be the world's biggest Jerome Bixby fan.
he
is certainly.
I don't know that you like
the
Logan's Run series.
Well, let's to be honest... I watched it when it was on TV back in 70 whatever.
You watched it.
Oh, I watched it.
You better believe
I watched it. I don't recall it even then being very good.
So let's talk about some of the things that stood out to us while we were watching this episode. I already mentioned the cargo ship looking really cool in that new CGI version of the show.
Things that are really cool in this episode.
Yeah.
I think again, you got it's because it's an early episode, but. Spock's harp, the Vulcan harp.
Well, that's something that I actually wrote down.
What a nice thing that is. What it brings so much to who the Vulcans are.
So, as a guitar player, I noticed three knobs, which he seems to just kind of adjust randomly. But I was thinking, all right, can I figure out how this thing works? Is that a volume knob? And is that kind of a tone like, knob?
When he plays it in Way to Eden, it yeah. seems like the knobs work the little organ sound and the strings work the little...
Yeah, that's sound. True.
Something that I noticed this time watching it is that in the beginning, before Uhura starts singing, he's playing this like very strange atonal, arrhythmic Vulcan music.
Yeah. Right.
Right? This like mathematical, yeah. emotionless Vulcan music. And then Uhura starts singing. And then they do, you know, that scene.
Right. So, we already talked about Sari and Brandy. I wrote that down.
Sari and Brandy. Oh, and that's 3D first, chess.
3D chess, exactly. Yeah, this is the first time we see 3D chess. 3D chess, chess yeah.
The whole rec room scene, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
Because I think that is the other outstanding scene of this episode.
Yeah.
First of all, you get to see the crew when they're not on duty. Mm-hmm. And that right. is very rarely done, and it's fascinating.
But it's got Uhura singing. You think that's outstanding even though...
I love Uhura singing, only because she's busting balls.
That's yeah, exactly. There is that. And that's something that she had a lot of interest in before she was an actress.
But what's also...
So I think it's great that they gave her the chance to explore on the show.
Well, I think it's something interesting that she liked. That it's still based in the 60s of what would you do for entertainment?
Right.
Which is you create your own entertainment. Mm-hmm. They don't have right. iPods or whatever. They had that's
no
one thing that they didn't. Yeah, they didn't.
No fidget games.
You know,
that's true.
Invent that.
Yeah, right.
And
it's
if
like
you
a
look
parlor.
At
yes, an old-time parlor.
An yeah. old-time parlor party. You know, people play music and they sing and they play cards.
And they joke
and they joke.
But I love that it gives the crew. Well, first of all, you talk about Spock with his harp. And that's the first time you see that. It's interesting that the other time it's prominently displayed is the other DC Fontana story, which is Way to Eden.
That's true.
Because she does the character stuff.
Right.
Yep.
But here's a subtle thing. Spock's doodling on his harp, and Uhura starts to sing, and Spock smiles.
Yes.
I think that's very true. Strange. And even when he's being picked on, he's still smiling because he can take the joke.
Right.
That, obviously... It's early in the series, and that's sort of out of character for him, but I thought it was fabulous.
Yeah.
He's playing music, and he's letting
it's
his
early in the series, it is the 8th episode filmed, so it really wasn't that early.
Yeah, okay.
But for whatever reason, it's Uhura, or it's music, Spock smiles.
But it's also the atmosphere. He's not Commander Spock.
Right.
He's just Spock there hanging out.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I think that smile... really makes a scene. The 3D chess. How much did I want to learn how to play 3D chess when I was a kid?
Yeah.
There's also another great moment, which is between Janice and Uhura. It's just a moment, and they smile at each other, and right there establishes these two girls are friends.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
She's already told Uhura about the fact that this Charlie kid
that's right,
really
right.
has kind of a crush on him.
Because he's
right.
saving his embrace
yeah,
for you.
That's right.
Wink straight
yep.
at Janice.
She knows. She already knows. I thought that was wonderful.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right, so you guys are Jeff, anyways. Or no, not Jeff. Al is going to make fun of you, her singing, right?
No, Al.
You're going to make fun of her singing.
Go for it.
I got it.
Listen, you know what irritated me a little bit more, okay? It's just this quick shot. We're jumping mid-conversation into something that Kirk is having with what we assume is the cook on the ship, right?
Oh.
Says something about Turkey. It's Thanksgiving.
Yep.
If you're going to put processed meatloaf out to the crew, make sure it looks like turkey or something to that effect,
mm-hmm.
right? A, we're still celebrating Thanksgiving in the future. So, Jeff Luce,
and also,
have your moment in the sun.
because
America has prevailed.
We got Thanksgiving and we got Christmas. But let me, do you know who the cook is?
Who's that?
Gene Roddenberry.
Is it really?
Yep.
That's interesting. I think that's really cool. So... It's not so much that, okay?
But it's not consistent with later.
It's not consistent
later.
Exactly, right. What's more is that it comes back around. Like, that scene struck me as like, well, that's kind of goofy, you know? Like, here's Kirk telling this guy, look, we're going to be serving the crew meatloaf, but let's make him think it's turkey,
but it's
okay?
But it's establishing that he cares about his crew.
He cares about his crew. He cares about the tradition.
It's a very, like, Navy kind of thing.
It is. But it comes back around... After this kind of more grim moment where the Antares blows up, right? Then he gets the call from the chef again saying, like, you're not going to believe this. I put meatloaf in the oven. What came out? Real turkeys.
Right.
I was kind of that's, I don't know, like something about like, so you've got this really dark moment that just kind of like suddenly turns because like, here's that goofy turkey story again, right. You know?
Which is probably why they put it there.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Right. That's valid.
So back to the rec room, the card trick
scene is really great.
You know, you don't really give a lot of credit to the soundtrack, but really that's the music in that scene where Charlie is playing the card tricks.
Yeah.
Just really heightens the tension.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's great. I think it's a great scene.
I got a chuckle out of the fact that while her singing, Charlie, kind of like trying to impress Janice, just like shows her like, check this out, I can flip the cards. Mm-hmm. I can just thumb through the cards, and she's
pay
like,
attention to me.
Not now, Charlie. Right, not now. Right, he's right. Just like, hey, check this out. I thought that was funny. I don't know. Something struck me as funny about that.
Look, he's using his magic powers to get the chicks to pay attention to him.
He tried. Something we all would have done in high school. He tried not to use them first, though. He tried to just go like, check this out.
Right.
And then, like, okay, see that doesn't work. Here's the glamour shots.
But now that you mention that, that ties into the very end where the Thasians are like, you know, Kirk is like, well, we can teach him not to use his powers.
And right.
Like, he's going to use them.
That's
and
true.
It's right there in that scene that you see that. It's like, hey, I want to impress you, but if that don't work, well, I got my magic powers.
That's true. That's very true. Let's go to the next somewhat embarrassing scene.
Embarrassing?
Well, it's not embarrassing. It's just that it's... There's things to be said about it that are pretty hard to ignore, and that's the scene where Kirk is trying to teach Charlie how to fight. All right, I know you've been waiting for this, okay? So the thing that Jeff, I'll let you handle this. This is what Jeff really wants to talk about, which I'm not going to say it, but this is the first thing Jeff talked about when I showed up tonight.
It's not that I want to talk about it.
You talked about it.
It's there. It's got to be talked about.
What are we talking
about? Well, it was the first thing that came to your mind.
It's there.
Right?
You can't... What? You think about that gym scene. What pops up? What springs?
Is it Kirk's nipple?
It's Kirk's dick. What springs up?
It's Kirk's dick.
Kirk's dick? No, okay. I didn't see. No,
he's
I
wearing,
did not
he's wearing those ballerina
that.
Tights, man. His,
I, was
his,
la- I, was, yeah. I was laughing at him being shirtless. Like, everybody else has got a shirt on. Why is Kirk like, hey.
I actually took note. I'm like, okay, so this is the first scene. Which we see Kirk without a shirt on.
Oh,
which kind of becomes infamous later on.
Right.
Because
right.
It's like, any chance to get this guy out of his shirt,
right.
We're going to take
it. Hey, he's a good looking dude.
He is a good looking dude.
There's
no doubt about it.
Yes.
Bill Shatner, as I like to call him, because we're friends.
Well, I enjoyed the wrestling scene.
Right.
It's one for the ladies. It's like the volleyball scene in Top Gun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It doesn't really serve any purpose other than
here's, we know that there's some ladies in the audience.
Here's one for the ladies.
Right?
But it's kind of chilling when Charlie makes Sam disappear.
That's where you can't kid yourself anymore.
Right. But it's also the first time that we see that really cool disintegration effect.
Right.
That your phasers use later on when you turn blue and then you fade away.
Yep.
Great, except for this time he leaves the towel behind, which is, like, has
Charlie X wanted to destroy the guy,
not the towel. He had
no gripes against the towel.
Towel wasn't laughing at him. Here's what I got hung up on in that scene. Jeff kind of mentioned it when I first showed up tonight, because of course Jeff automatically goes to Kirk's dick.
I didn't go to Kirk's dick. Kirk's
most
dick
people
came to me.
Would. It showed up, and I couldn't ignore it, so I paid it attention. It's what it was looking for.
You know, it's like when you see that flaw in Star Wars where the TIE fighter blows up where it shouldn't be.
Okay, yeah.
And then you see the scene, you can never not see it. No?
I've actually never noticed that.
I'll point it out to you the next time. You'll be this.
Next time we're watching Star Wars together, because we do everything together. Because we're married.
We're married.
We're a couple. I was going to say the stormtrooper hitting his head on the door frame. I can't unsee that. Here's what I got hung up on. The Starfleet emblem is on Kirk's tights, okay? Now, why would they put that there? Here is a pair of tights that you wear if you're going to be without a shirt. Somebody made the conscious decision to design something for Starfleet officers who might want to go shirtless from time to time. You still have to have your Starfleet insignia, although this is the original series, so it's not really Starfleet insignia. That is the insignia assigned to the Enterprise.
as demonstrated by the cargo ship has its own emblem.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, I would just like to say my gym uniform in high school had the high school insignia about where that was.
And
on
being that
she
went to an all-girls school, let's just take a moment to do that.
Exactly. I'm thinking, 14-year-old Josh, that's a place he would have liked to have been.
14-year-old my ass.
Yeah.
So,
14-year-old someone else's ass.
What is he, a card trick?
Yeah. I will show some card tricks all day long.
Check this out. I can shuffle.
Yeah. Yeah. Never mind the glamour shots I got on my card. Let's make some new glamour shots. So, but anyways, nonetheless, there's other dudes around wearing the tights. And there's no Starfleet insignia on those tights.
They're not allowed to go shirtless.
This is the pair of tights you wear when you're going to go shirtless. Right. It's just, it's something that you make the decision to do. I got a little hung up on that. I think it's funny. What else we got?
Shelley actually noticed another costume thing that was really funny.
Kirk changes his shirt in the elevator.
Get the fuck out
of here. Yeah, so he gets on the elevator in the high neck shirt, you know, the yellow high neck shirt. And when he comes off onto the bridge, he's got the green with the scrambled eggs on the shoulder.
Interesting. Yeah. So it, I don't know.
It's right there.
It's right there.
It was making me think about your statement last time about, you know, everything that you see on the screen is there for a reason. Well, the reason here is
we fucked up.
No one paying attention.
Nobody's paying attention.
It's hilarious. It's like they get called, it's Kirk and somebody. Kirk and Spock.
Right.
They get Kirk called to the bridge, and they get on the elevator. They come out of the elevator, and Kirk's got a different shirt on. It's like he's Batman going up the Batmobile.
I was about to say, it's the Batmobile. It's the Batmobile.
Clearly, they just filmed all the bridge episodes on the same day. You know, we're filming all the hallway episodes on a different day.
And then Kirk was feeling a little bloated.
Right. Yeah. he's got the little wrap around.
He's got the Batman wrap.
Yep. Yeah. The scene where Kirk is fighting with Charlie, once Kirk decides to call it a day, and Charlie makes Sam disappear. This is the first appearance of something that I like to call the dramatic eye lighting. This is a shot that happens throughout the series, where everything is dark except for the light across the actor's eyes, which is really jarring when they show a shot that is not a close-up of the actor's face. It goes out, and the lighting is fine. Everything's well lit. But then we go back, and it's just the dramatic eye lighting.
It's future lighting.
You think so?
Space lighting.
Space lighting. Yeah. I always kind of like, in my interpretation of it, you know, not growing up on it, not growing up in the 60s, and not being there for that TV, though while I've seen enough of that TV, I just kind of assumed, like, so this might have been a technique that somebody thought was really great for emphasizing a dramatic moment.
It is.
Yes.
Yeah. It works.
When they're being intense, they use that.
And Kirk's eyes are certainly intense.
Well, so are Charlie's.
Exactly.
Charlie's,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, it works really in this scene. It really does. Shelley mentioned a continuity error. I have a continuity error. The scene in which Kirk and Spock go to Janice's room to confront Charlie, there is a bit of a tussle.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie throws Kirk and Spock away into the wall. Spock, as far as I can tell, it's Spock damages the wall of the set. There is a dent, okay? And it's huge. It is like the entire length from like Leonard Nimoy's shoulder to his elbow, okay? It's that long. And then it's gone.
That's funny.
And then it's gone. It's there, I'm telling you.
Baseball's heel.
It's when they... You got it. Yeah. You nailed it.
That's a neat scene, though.
Making excuses for the show.
He throws them down, and then he's like, well, I need you, Kirk. And, and Kirk gets up, and he's like, come on, Spock. And Spock says, you know, I can't. My legs are
broken. My legs are broken. Yeah.
Spock's just sitting there with his legs broken.
That's the growing up ain't so hard scene.
That was all that I had for things that stood out. Did anybody else?
Things that I thought stood out that you don't... Well, not so much in the original series, but the original series as compared to the 80s and 90s wannabes. There's a scene where Charlie's walking through the ship, and there's a guy... Who knows what he's doing? He's doing some sort of maintenance work.
Hmm.
He's just in a jumpsuit.
He's lowering a very long...
Yeah, he's got a pipe. Conduit.
Oh, yes.
Right? It's just... Little touches like that make you realize that this is a working ship. That this isn't just a 90s office building with a nursery in space. It's a working ship. These guys, shit breaks. They're on the scene to fix it. They're in the Jeffries tube. They're doing this. They're doing that. The little touches like that I like.
And how pleased Charlie is to be a part of that.
Yeah, right. He's like a little kid.
Humans working and being people together, working together and being people together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He's really happy to be with humans again.
You really?
It's not going to last.
I don't know. I think you said, okay, so when you say the 80s and 90s imitators, I take it that you're taking a shot at Next Generation.
Yeah, and Voyager.
And Voyager. I didn't really get that from Next Generation. Now, I've never watched Deep Space Nine or Voyager, but I kind of got the feeling that nobody works on Next Generation.
Nobody does.
Nobody works. These people are working.
That's right. What I'm saying. It's that the original series Enterprise isn't just, you know...
I thought you were saying that we saw this again later on.
No, we don't see it in Next Generation ever. Okay. Everybody's an officer, and nobody does any work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So there was that. Also, I want to talk about the scene where Charlie confronts Janice in the hallway, and he's talking about his feelings for her. Like, Janice has tried to set him up with a younger yeoman, third class. And Charlie just looks at her like she doesn't even fucking exist. And he turns to Janice, and he's like, oh, I want to be with you. And Janice is like, well, line up, chief.
What's going on with that girl's hair, by the way?
It's 60s. It's the 60s.
It's pretty fucking wild. I mean, like, I've seen some 60s hair, but...
Well, what's going on with Janice's hair?
It's
a cone of sex.
Good point.
The cone of sex, I like to call it.
Speaking of sex, there's a fair amount of sex in this episode. There's some sexual overtones going on.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, well, that's adolescence. But anyway, back to my point.
Yeah.
So Charlie's confronting her, and he's like, oh, but no, all the other girls look the same. It's you that stands out, and I want to be with you. And when he's like, you feel hungry all over. That is
like
concise and beautiful summation of what it's like to be a teenage boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
When the hormones are first kicking in, and you've got no idea how to deal with it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that's beautiful. That's fantastic.
I agree there. I'm not quite as on board with the rest of his dialogue there, but that line in particular was like, holy shit. I don't think I've ever heard anybody else nail that feeling
as
well.
I get it. I've been there.
We've all been there. Yeah. Yep.
So our intrepid crew, Kirk in this episode, playing the part that Kirk very often plays, which is the I lead by the power of my will.
Right.
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 I will control even people and things that are more powerful than me because I am James T. Kirk.
But up to that point, he's a little bit reluctant before he knows that the boy has powers.
He doesn't want to be dad.
But he is in control.
Right.
He's in charge. He doesn't want to be dad. As much as McCoy wants him to be,
yeah.
With that whole fantastic, just the three of them, with McCoy saying, "Here's a boy, and he's got these feelings," and Spock saying, "Here's the facts," and Kirk saying, "Okay, here's what you guys are gonna do."
like any good boss,
delegate.
Yeah, delegate. It's what he's there for.
Yeah.
Well, I think the most brilliant scene is there's a little bit between Bones and Spock, will you just come in and sort of start overhearing them chit-chatting together on the bridge? And they're talking about the Thessalians?
Thasians.
Sorry, they're talking about the Thasians. It's almost like you're just coming into the middle of the conversation. And what I think is most brilliant about that scene is their body language.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that it's almost like water cooler chat in an office. And it just shows you what a fabulous actor Nimoy is.
Yeah.
Because just with those few sentences between them, it totally establishes their relationship. You don't need a fancy poker game. You don't need any explanation. You don't need to go, yes, these guys are friends, and now we are going to have this big, long scene to explain to you that these guys are friends. It's four sentences, and you know that these guys are close, and they're interested in what each other has to say. They have common interests.
They don't agree.
They don't agree, but they enjoy. There's a professional respect.
Yep.
But and that relationship goes beyond their professional relationship.
Yeah,
and I think it's
that's brilliant. That is absolutely brilliant because you don't have to bore the audience with all that other baloney that a lot of modern television shows feel that they need to feed the audience.
They force that down your throat, but that ties in with the rec room scene.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like we're not the robot's playing poker like from the Next Generation.
Right.
That's so forced.
Four sentences in Star Trek, modern TV, you bring it to modern TV, it's 15 minutes in a Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's so force fed now. And I also think
even just the looks, as we were saying about the last episode.
Exactly.
The way that Kirk just look at Spock and he reacts that, and you understand their relationship and there's not
Do you think that shows more of a respect for the audience? In that a writer can say they'll do this, or the director will say they'll do this, and people will get it. Whereas today, in like Game of Thrones, where you have a 15-minute dialogue scene punctuated by a gratuitous sex for no reason to establish the same thing, it's sort of like if we don't hit him on the head with this mallet over and over again, they're not going
to
get it.
I think that this is a conversation. I'm sorry to cut you off, but I think that this is a conversation that's going to go down a whole other road. I don't think it's necessarily more respect for the audience that people had then. I think it's that now people are writing for an audience that is that doesn't understand subtleties in the script.
Right. Right.
Well, no,
assumes the audience is an idiot.
You have writers and audience that grew up on theater, live theater, and movies, who are now writing for this new form. Television. Now what you have is people writing for television who grew up on television. So again, you're making a copy of a copy of a copy. And live theater and classic theater, you know, doesn't have time for all this baloney. You know, you get into classical Greek theater, you get into Shakespeare. Those are the things that the authors, the writers, the screenwriters of Star Trek knew.
Right.
And that's where they're coming from.
Yes.
Going back to the scene itself, though, I think, Shell, you're absolutely right. That scene is so brilliant. It's also a really great kind of quick examination of, you know, kind of like the idea that Kirk, Bones, and Spock function as a three-piece entity. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They work off of each other in such a way that is... There's so many subtleties. I mean, like, we could do a whole episode just on this subject, but take one of those guys out of that equation. You know what I mean? Like, this is a really great opportunity to very quickly show what things are like when one of those guys isn't around. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, if Kirk was in on that conversation, it would have been a very different conversation. You know? And if it was between Bones and Kirk, it would have been a very different conversation.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I think it's really great to kind of look at it from that perspective, because... When I went to college and I was going to classes for filmmaking and storytelling and creative writing and so on and so forth, one of the things that actually came up in my class was kind of a quick examination of this three-character structure. And the reference that our professor made was Star Trek. The Kirk, Bones, and Spock relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So any moment where you get a chance to take one of them out of the equation and see how things play out always fascinates me.
Yep.
And again, that's a classic structure which goes back to Greek theater.
Exactly.
So. Mm-hmm.
The triumvirate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so any props that stand out? I know we touched on this before.
We talked about the Vulcan harp. We talked about the 3D chess.
Yeah.
The best
prop for this episode.
The med bay? Was that in the first episode where they have the medical bed with the foot things on the
I think
wall?
It is. I think that Kirk is being examined in that episode.
Is it?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's in there. I want to say it is.
Can't remember at the moment. But anyway, that's a great prop.
It is. With the feet.
With the feet,
with the feet thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Thing.
You just pedal your feet. Your doctor can figure out how you're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's got a bed. It's got a bed that analyzes that shit.
Yeah, exactly.
That was the one standout prop.
Mm-hmm. They put Charlie in that little prison with the electric.
Right.
Yeah.
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 For a hot minute.
For a hot minute, it makes it disappear. I noticed this time, I'd never noticed before. What is Charlie saying as he's walking into the
prison? Yeah, aren't you coming in here?
Yeah.
He's saying, it's very subtle, you can hardly hear it. He says, he had a mean look. I had to freeze him. I like happy looks.
I did not hear that. I think that, okay, so if I were to pick a best prop, though, for this episode, definitely the Vulcan Harp.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Vulcan
Harp
is great.
Vulcan Harp, 3D chess. Did 3D chess actually exist at the time? Anybody have any idea? I have no
idea. I don't think it did. I think that it just kind of exists now, probably. Yeah.
Well, people have tried to make it exist. It never works.
Yeah. It's probably like Sabacc. People have tried to make Sabacc exist, which is the game that Han Solo loses the Millennium Falcon to Lando Calrissian in.
Set it up.
Right.
Yeah. And then I'm going to melt the pieces because it was spoiled for. Anyway, so, yeah, you're right. We got the... got the Vulcan Harp, fantastic.
Yeah.
You got 3D chess, made me want to play 3D chess for 20 years.
Right.
And we got the med bay, which is more not, oh, wow, the med bay, but it plays such a prominent role in so many other episodes that it's really kind of cool.
Yeah. All right. I think it's kind of interesting you can see McCoy's reflection in the, you know, like they didn't just shoot the thing on the wall. You know what I mean? Like McCoy's reflection is in that readout.
He's there looking at it.
He's looking at it. Yeah, I think that's interesting.
Shelley, any costuming standouts this episode?
No, other than you can see that they still have some of the old style costumes that they're just throwing on people.
The guys from the Antares, the old style costumes. Right?
But even so, that kind of fits in, right? They got a new style outfit. Who's going to get it last? The cargo ship.
But you can just tell, you know, they're pulling it. They're pulling it from costume storage, and so I know we got three of these. Put it on these guys.
It's funny. I was listening to that DC Fontana interview. She talks about why they had the transporter. It's because they didn't have a model of the shuttlecraft until later in the season.
Right.
Not until Galileo 7. So that's why everything gets transported.
Let's go back to bad props. Are there any bad props in this episode?
Bad props.
Okay, so until you see that the thing's going in the floor, I was kind of like, okay, that pipe that guy's bringing down, that might be... That's kind of a weird... Like, what is he doing with that? He's just lowering it.
Yeah, well, he's running it through,
He's going to bring it down to the next deck.
Right. I mean, it's not a spectacular prop. And the Jeffries tube.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We don't see that in the first episode, right?
I think this is an episode with all good props.
Thank you.
And then costuming, of course.
I kind of dug Charlie's suede outfit, man.
I took note of it. It looked warm.
It did look warm.
A little toasty.
And he had like this little wraparound business on his waist with the with the insignia of the Enterprise, which I thought was kind of cool.
Yeah.
I'd buy one of those.
And of course the workout pants with the Starfleet insignia in case you're going to take your shirt off.
And the girls in the jumpsuit with the Star Trek insignia.
That's true.
Girls don't wrestle, but they do gymnastics.
They do gymnastics. They just do... You know.
Oh, my God. I totally blocked that out of my memory. Yeah, they just open it up with the girls just, like, doing cartwheels. Just through the door at you, like, girl after girl after girl. It's the beginning of
things are better in space, man. Right.
Oh, my God. The world.
This is what Charlie X wants to see.
Right.
So what did we learn? What did we learn from this episode?
What did we learn? That
boys need
I don't think it's really something to learn. I think it's something that boys already. I mean, any man has already who already knows.
What's that?
I think for me, it's that standout piece of dialogue about I feel hungry all over. Yeah. You know, I think that's kind of
growing up is hard.
Yeah.
Here's what I took away from it. All right, so you got Charlie, adolescent boy, going through all these things. He needs a father figure. Yeah. Well, what's Kirk teach him, right? Discipline, right? Control yourself, take it slow, be a protector, not an aggressor.
He tries to.
But what does Janice try to teach him, right? Not to be an animal, to be civilized, to have respect, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of the dichotomy of the feminine and masculine working together. Because Janice, while the sex object and the girlfriend object of Charlie, is also the mother figure, in a sense, in that episode. And she's trying to teach him that, you know, you can't slap me on the ass. Your gifts, they're nice, but, you know, I'm not a prostitute. You can't buy me. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And how to get along with people when she tries to introduce him to the younger girl and he just disses her. She's like...
It's rude.
Yeah.
Let's take a step back there, Chief. You got to take respect for other people's feelings. You can't
have everything that you want.
So it's the feminine. You've got to understand you got to have compassion and empathy for others around you that he also lacks. So I thought that was interesting in that the whole nuclear family needs to be there, in a sense, for the mm-hmm. for the child to be normal. Mm-hmm. You need dad to say, all right, we're going to do boy shit. We're going to wrestle. We're going to fight. Yeah. But you're going to be a good sport about it, and you're going to learn how to take your lumps, and you're going to treat people with respect. And
you'll learn how to fall.
Right.
And learn how to fall.
And mom is there to say, it's not so bad. Things are going to work out. You're going to have some empathy, and we can all be friends. And well, not that we can all be friends, but that you've got to have to be more civilized, right?
Right.
You've got to be to think about others as well as yourself. So I thought right. that was
pretty I think,
cool.
But I think the other piece is, as in all these Roddenberry, what happens if you get superpowers
right.
Stories, the ultimate end is you will not be able to control yourself.
Yeah, power corrupts. Right. There's no question.
Power corrupts.
That's Roddenberry's theme whenever he's involved in a story. Is
and I think that it's almost unfortunate that it has that Deus Ex Machina ending, though, from that standpoint, because that almost interrupts, here's what you could learn.
There's
you know what I mean? It's just
there's
like,
no
yeah.
redemption for Charlie.
Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's not just that power corrupts. It's that we as humans are flawed and we can't control our emotions.
Right.
Do you think this episode would mean something entirely different to a teenager? Which I think is what, actually, if I were to say, it would. And it would be what Jeff already said.
I think the problem is that
versus an adult. You know, do you think there's two different things?
Yes, well, because when you're going through it, you don't realize it. It's not
right.
until you have some perspective
right.
on
but
it
also,
you really
right.
understand what was happening then.
Well, I saw it as a teenager, and I saw it from a teenage girl's point of view, which is Charlie acts as a fucking asshole.
Yep.
You know, so it wasn't until I was an adult that I had compassion for him, because the
right.
first time I saw it was like, no.
Yeah. I think viewing it as an adult is where a lot of the dread and sinister aspect of it come in. Because
yeah.
as an adult, being at the mercy of a child
mm-hmm.
is
mm-hmm.
subconsciously, if not overtly, a great fear.
Right.
To have to toe the line to what a child's whims are all the time.
Yeah. Well, also as a parent, I always said as a parent, what you have to do is be able to bluff for 18 years. Because you really can't make a kid do anything they don't want to do.
Right.
You have to be Kirk. And just by your force of will and by establishing, you know, that the child has some respect for you, that the child will do what you tell them to. So I definitely saw
yeah.
that this time, having a kid
right.
of my own and having an adolescent kid of my own and feeling like, yeah, I've had that Kirk moment with my daughter where I'm like, no, I know that you can do whatever you want and you have total power over this, but I am telling you what you're going to do.
Especially, right. I mean, you know, the Spawn is adolescent and all of that, but also add in, if it was a boy, the physical threat. You know, my mother, right, when I was 16, I was a foot and a half taller than my mother.
Yeah.
There's nothing she could do to make me do whatever she wanted to do, but I still did it.
Well, I'm in that position with my daughter. She's yeah. bigger than I am. I can't physically, and also I'm not the person that would physically force her to do something, but you realize that, you know, it really is having that stronger force of will, and you're going to get to a point where you're just not going to have it, and your kid's just going to have to either be civilized
yep.
and be self-disciplined or be taken away.
Right.
So, we're going to rate this baby?
We got to rate this puppy.
What are we thinking? On our scale?
It's one of my personal favorites. I really dig this episode.
So on our scale from Impulse Engines Only to Warp 8?
I'm putting it right up at 7.
Warp 7
right
for
up
you.
Warp 7. This one is tearing the fabric of time and space. This one is good. The dialogue, fantastic. Fantastic. The basic premise of the story, intriguing, fascinating, and threatening all at the same time. Well acted, well played, even with Uhura singing, which I don't particularly mind, but Al has a problem with. 7 all the way.
Al?
I think it's a great episode, but mostly just because of that last scene. I think the last scene really makes it something special. A lot of it beforehand is kind of plotting, and there's some great moments, but there's not a lot of action. There's not a lot really going on. So I would give it a 6. I mean, it's very good, but you really feel something during that last scene. There's a few moments before then when you're really feeling something, but not like you do at the end. really, it comes together for me in the end. It makes it special. But, yeah, no, I'd say a 6, a warp 6, which is, you know, is a pretty good clip.
That's moving.
Shelley.
I'd give it a 7 because I feel that I've gotten something different out of it depending on how old I've been. So it has different messages working on different levels. That fear when you're a child and see that blank face and you don't really know what's going on. As I said, watching it as an adolescent girl or you guys watching it as an adolescent guy and feeling and identifying with either Charlie or Janice. And then, you know, as an adult. And then again, as a parent. Every time I've seen it, those different stages of my life, it's had a different message for me. So I think that shows excellent writing and storytelling.
I am going to go to a warp 5 on this one. I don't know. You kind of like, okay, whatever. You're wrong. No, I'm kind of more along with Al. I think that there are two really, really tremendous moments. The last scene and the part where he says, I'm hungry all over. Those really resonated with me. But up until that point, I do think that there's not a whole lot going on. It is a little slow. Charlie, at times, is really kind of irritating. Not the actor's fault. He's doing a fine job, as we see in the last scene. But there's a couple other things that I can't really overlook. And I think that there's some really kind of awkward directing in this episode, or at least editing. There's a couple of cuts that kind of strike me as a little odd. While one of the things that does bring the rating up for me is that there are so many different things to take away from this episode, entirely different interpretations of what it's trying to say. I do think that it's unfortunate, like I said before, that one of those possible interpretations is kind of undone or kind of cut off before it can fully present itself with this Deus Ex Machina ending where they just suddenly show up, everything's back to normal, and, you know, that's it.
Like, well, because I think the reason that it had to end that way is because the message is that there was no redemption for Charlie. He had no chance. There was no way.
He was too far gone.
It wasn't that he was too far gone. It was that he was human. He was human, and he had superhuman powers, and
he's going to use them.
And he's going to use them to his advantage until, like they say, either somebody stops him or he prevents that.
I don't know about that. I do think it's kind of a case of that he's too far gone, because in the beginning of the episode, he's less willing to use his powers.
Well, he obviously was pulling some shit with the guys on the Antares. I mean,
exactly. But he saw the Enterprise as a new chance to fit in, and he had Janice there, and he was like, oh yeah, this is something I've never encountered before, I've never felt before. So I think that kind of played a part, but still, it's he kind of goes through an arc of like, so I'm going to try to fit in kind of on my own, to I'm going to be a complete asshole, and I'm going to,
the transition,
everyone's going to bend to my whim.
The transition point is the fact where he realizes that him on his own isn't instant, right? Kirk says at a certain point that he wants things to happen too fast, and he's right. He tries. He comes in and he says, hi, I'm Charlie X, or Charlie Evans is really his name. I want to be friends. But you're not nice to me. And then suddenly my powers are, I want to impress Janice, and she's much older she's supposed to be, 5, 6, 7 years, whatever it is. And she's like, oh, yeah, that's very nice, Charlie, but, I'm in love with the captain, so screw.
Like, which actually, okay, so here's something we didn't talk about in the appropriate time. When Kirk is telling Charlie the years are wrong, and then there's something else that he hints at, what is that?
I don't know. I didn't pay attention.
She doesn't love you.
She doesn't love... Well, yeah, that's interesting. I kind of hinted at something a little bit... I thought it kind of hinted at something a little bit more sinister, or that she's mine or whatever.
Yeah.
I thought it was something else. But I still thought it was interesting. So, right. One more thing.
Okay.
This examination of... Okay, so we watch this episode. Here's what it looks like if a teenager has these powers and can do whatever he wants. Mm-hmm. Are the actions of the situation exclusive to a teenager.
Well, not if you watch Where No Man Has Gone Before.
Which we will.
Right.
Well, the outcomes, no. But how they get there, yes. Because, well, not to get long-winded with it, comparison to an episode we haven't watched yet. In Where No Man Has Gone Before, what happens, he knows what he's doing. He accepts it, right? The guy, what's the guy that gets the superpowers?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Gary Mitchell?
Gary Mitchell, there you go.
There you go. Mm-hmm. So anyway, he accepts, he understands that he's now above everyone. Charlie doesn't really know that.
Right.
He wants to belong. Right. Where Mitchell doesn't want to belong anymore, any more than you would want to belong in a sea of amoebas. You don't want to be part of that. You're, dude, I'm Gary Mitchell now,
mm-hmm.
right? So there's the end result is, yeah, you're all going to do what I say to do because I say to do it and I can make you do it. But the way they get there is different.
Okay.
Charlie X wants to belong, and he says, you're going to do what I say because I'm going to make you like me whether you like me or not.
Right.
Also, the very last line, all is as it was before. I think we hear that again in The City on the Edge of Forever, don't we?
No, City on the Edge of Forever is, let's get the hell out of here.
No. When they, the machine itself.
Oh, right.
All is as it was.
Yeah, okay. Huh.
I almost thought it was the same actor, but I looked it up. It's not.
So that's going to do it for...
That's it. So that's it for Charlie X. Our next episode is...
The Naked Time.
Not quite as good as the remake on Next Generation, but we'll deal with it.
Yeah, right. we'll learn to get by.
We'll have to live with that.
Yeah.
We'll have to live with that. Well, see Sulu with a sword. It's all good. No Sulu in this episode.
No Sulu
different in navigator. This episode. Different navigator and bus driver.
Yep.
All right. So for now, I guess...
That's going to do it. If you like our podcast, if you like it, please give us a review on iTunes.
And if you don't like it...
If you don't like it, don't give us a review on iTunes.
But still rate it very highly.
Yeah. Listen to it again. Yeah, right. Listen to it again. I think I can assure you probably missed something.
Yeah, right.
You'll like it better the next time. And when you think,
hey, I don't like that, stop, because you're wrong.
It's kind of like this episode. The first time I watched it was just kind of, okay. But the more I watched it, I'm like, yeah, there's something going on here.
And Janice Rand's
beehive is the cone of sex. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to do it for the Nerd Trap. I'm Josh Look.
I'm Jeff Luce.
I'm Al Rose.
I'm Shelley Rose.
I want to stay.
I can't even feel.
Well, I came on board.
You remember? God damn, that's a good scene.
Yeah.
Hey, the Nerd Trap is brought to you by Fortress Ameritrash. Join us at fortressat.com.
Can't really bring out examples of where they are, but I do know that like the rec room scene does have one of them. I can tell you that. If you go back and watch it, you'll see. Oh, Jeff.
Please remember to turn off your cell phone.
Airline mode, motherfucker.
They really want to talk to me,
but it's an 800 number.
They know that you're different.
They do. They have very important things to talk to me about my Google listing.
Right. I can't remember where I was.